Rainmaker FM. You're listening to The Digital Entrepreneur, the show for folks who want to discover smarter ways to create and sell profitable digital goods and services. This podcast is a production of Digital Commerce Institute, the place to be for digital entrepreneurs. For more information, go to rainmaker.fm/digital commerce. That's rainmaker.fm/digital commerce.
Welcome to The Digital Entrepreneur. I'm your host, Sean Jackson, and I'm joined as always by the tenacious Katie Katz. Katie, how are you today?
Hey, Sean. I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, I am fantastic. The cold and flu season is over for me, and I'm a happy camper. So,
amen.
Amen. Amen. So for today's show, Katie, I want to talk about growth, and specifically growing a business. And I want to pose a question to you, given your expertise in helping numerous companies grow. What is the thing that you would say really helps companies go and grow?
Yeah. So in my experience, being on the consulting side of it, especially helping with growth tactics and marketing, there has to be a point where you identify a process, a recipe that works, finding something that works for your business, whatever that may be, whether it's finding really cheap ad space and getting it to the right people that converts, or if it's spreading a word of mouth campaign, whatever that scalable, repeatable process is, that's really the way to, you know, scale your success. But it takes a really specific person at the entrepreneur side for that to work. Like, no matter what recipe you have, it won't matter if you don't have the right person. And that's one of the reasons I'm really excited to have our guest on today, because I think he'll be able to help us break that down a little bit.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think today's show is really thinking about growth and the mindset that it takes to grow, right? Because we all have started something and we'll get to certain points and we're going to have to make other decisions about how to grow further. And I think you're right. Today's guest has literally taken an idea with his business partner in the cornfields of Tennessee and turned it into a substantial, fast-growing business. And his thinking about that, I believe you, our audience, are going to love, because he talks about how that company went from idea to the stages of growth, and more importantly, the mindset that helped them succeed. And we will talk to him when we get back from this short break.
Hey, my name is Brian Gardner, and I am the creator of StudioPress, the first premium marketplace for WordPress themes. When I created StudioPress, I could never imagine that more than 200,000 WordPress site owners would use StudioPress to build some of the most elegant and inspiring WordPress sites on the web. And I am not just talking about the numerous large companies that use it. Tens of thousands of food bloggers, podcasters, affiliate marketers, real estate agents, photographers, and many more have created some of the most compelling mobile responsive websites using StudioPress. But that is not all. To make it easy for you to create a compelling WordPress site, we have introduced StudioPress Sites, a turnkey simple method to create and grow your WordPress site. StudioPress Sites includes many of our most popular WordPress themes, with unique SEO tools and plugins all integrated on our high-performance, secure, and actively managed hosting infrastructure. So when you are ready to take your WordPress site to a new level without the worry or hassle of less robust solutions, then I hope you will visit StudioPress.com. Over 200,000 bloggers and webmasters trust StudioPress for their WordPress site, and we work hard every day to earn it.
Welcome back from the break. And Katie, it's that time of the show for us to interview our very special guest. Will you please introduce him?
Absolutely. Today we have Brandon Bruce, who is the co-founder and COO of Cirrus Insight, a SaaS platform that connects Gmail and Outlook with Salesforce. And since launching in 2011, Brandon's grown Cirrus to a funded company that sits at number 41 on the Inc. 500, using largely what he calls scrappy tactics. So we're really excited to have him today to learn a little bit more about how we can all do that.
Hey, Brandon, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Katie. Thanks, Sean. It's great to be here.
Okay, so before the show, you told us a very funny story and a piece of advice you give to all entrepreneurial founders, which is never go to Disneyland when you're starting out. Can you explain that wonderful piece of wisdom to our audience?
Yeah, so we launched at the end of 2011, and in early 2012, Ryan, my co-founder, and I decided to take our families, we both have young kids, to Disneyland. So I'm based in Knoxville. Ryan's based in Irvine, not too far from Disneyland. So not too long after arriving at the park, and remember, this was 6 years ago, Amazon Web Services had perhaps its largest outage of all time. So it took down Netflix and Instagram and a bunch of other, you know, really famous applications, but also tens of thousands of other really tiny applications like Cirrus Insight at the time. So we were in line, you know, for the small world, in the happiest place on earth, and I got about 30 phone calls simultaneously, which very briefly I thought, this is awesome. Everyone's found out about Cirrus Insight and they're ready to buy. But I was quickly dispelled of that notion when people said, hey, this is mission critical. Like, we're trying to do Salesforce from inside our Gmail inbox and it's not loading anymore, at which point we found out Amazon was down and we had no real ability to help our customers when we were in the middle of Disneyland. So yeah, until you have that some supporting staff in place, I think better not go to Disneyland until you're really ready.
Good advice.
Yeah.
So Brandon, you have part of your story is that you came from a small town and have made it to the big city, big world, and you started with a small company, have grown it to this large organization. And from my experience, this idea of having scalable, repeatable processes is really the secret sauce to being able to do something like that. Do you have like a winning recipe that would work for any company to be able to scale?
I mean, I think it was interesting. I was having a conversation on the phone earlier this morning, and it really boiled down to the small things make the biggest differences. And so I think, yeah, I'm kind of that classic kind of operations nerd, if you will, so that, you know, if the bus shows up on time, then I'm really impressed by it. You know, if the menu is self-explanatory, things like that, I think make a big difference. So I think small things, one good example would be, and we've used this since it first appeared on the internet, is the ability to make it really easy for customers to schedule time with us. So in an era where buyers have already done the majority of their research before reaching out for contact or before doing a demo, if you're in the software business, digital goods business like we are, they're already relatively knowledgeable. They kind of know the questions that they want to ask. And so if there's any barriers to them getting in touch with you, that's a big problem, because why not just get in touch with a competitor instead? So we made it easy for them to schedule time on all of our salespeople's calendars. For our existing customers, they can schedule time with our customer success team. And that's made a big difference, just you know, making ourselves accessible. So that would be one of those small things, sharing our calendars, that has made a big difference. And in fact, when I received my first email invitation to a meeting from someone years ago, and it had a bunch of times listed in the email, and it said, if any of these are convenient, just go ahead and click on one and it will automatically add it to both of our calendars. And I thought, this is awesome. Like, I'm going to schedule time with this person. I don't even have to reply to the email. So I did a little digging and found the small company that made that application that enabled that feature to be able to put your calendar information into an email. And then we acquired that company about 3-4 years ago. And that's been one of the greatest additions to the Cirrus Insight stack, is simply the ability to let your customers schedule time with you. So yeah, one small example of, you know, a little operations sales productivity hack that I would recommend to anybody, regardless of what type of business you're in, whether you're an entrepreneur or you're a long-standing business or just looking to get started in doing market research. Send that link out to everybody and let them schedule time with you, and then have those interviews. And that's where all of us that are in the product business kind of get smart. It's typically not on our own, unfortunately. It's typically based on what our customers are telling us.
So I'm glad you brought this up because, you know, one of the things that I think it's easy to forget when you see a company like yours that has grown successfully is that at one point it was just two guys, right? At one point it was a tiny little entity. And you weren't in Silicon Valley. You weren't in New York. You weren't in one of the hotbeds for technology out there. Right. So talk a little bit about those early days and how you thought about growing from there, because so many people who listen to this show are very small organizations, but they do have aspirations of doing something more. So let's kind of peel back into that, because, again, we're starting from scratch. What was it like? What were some of the key decisions you made as you thought about being a bootstrapped company? I mean, were VCs on the radar? Were you forgetting about the fact that, you know, they're not going to fund you because you're not in a hotbed? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. So our company is based in two places, and one is with me in Knoxville, Tennessee. So the first office was just me at my dining table looking over a cornfield. So yeah, not the quintessential hotbed of technology. We found out that Knoxville has been a great community for me to work in and to focus. And I think that's one advantage of being in a smaller market or sort of outside of the grid of the San Francisco's, New York, Chicago's, Boston's, Austin's of the world. And those are all awesome cities, and I love to go there. But being outside the spin zone sometimes can be really helpful simply for focus. You know, there's not 100 or 1,000 other app companies sprouting out left and right, and you can potentially get distracted. Instead, you just laser focus on what you're trying to accomplish and get to market. So I think that was good for me individually. And it's also been helpful for scaling our team, is because there's folks here. We have a great university system here, and there's folks in the community that want to be part of a, you know, technology startup, fast growth type experience. And rather than needing to leave and look elsewhere for that, those are the exact people that we're looking for. So it's a great match. Meanwhile, Ryan, my co-founder, is in Irvine in California. One of the things that we realized very early on, because we went up to the Bay Area to participate in a pitch, is after we gave the pitch and we got some initial feedback and some interest from different investors, one of the almost uniform pieces of feedback was, well, gosh, if you're not within 50 miles of the city center of San Francisco or 50 miles from Palo Alto, like we won't fund you, we're not interested. Or even according to our bylaws, we can't fund you. We're so laser focused on this particular area where we think all the great technology is going to come from. And if we're all honest, much of it does. But there's so many opportunities outside of that box. So because I went in thinking like, gosh, I wonder if this will be a barrier since I'm, you know, in kind of the Southeast. But it was even if we introduced Ryan and said, oh, he's in Irvine, they'd be like, well, Irvine's a little bit too far outside of where we like to fund, which we thought was really interesting. So yeah, we really got the company off the ground ourselves and with the help of friends and family. And, you know, family are really the ones that back most startups of any type, whether it's a service company or a digital company like we are, any company. It's usually, you know, yourself and your family that kind of believe in your ability to go do work. They don't necessarily know the exact business that you're in. They're not going to vet the whole go-to-market plan, but it's a bet on you as a person. And so we were really grateful to have that support and be able to get the initial app off the ground. Then thankfully, we were able to start selling it to customers right away and start generating some of that positive cash flow, pay off some of those initial family loans. So that was, then we were free and clear to start growing the company. And then it became, yeah, we would have kind of a consistent dance with possible venture capital investors, but it was never quite the right fit. And so what we did do is raise some money from angel investors, which included some individuals, as well as some early customers that basically said, look, we really like the application. We think it has a great future and we'd like to be part of that story. And that was great. We were like, wow, that's a huge vote of confidence. We'd love to have you be part of the story. And having some of that early angel funding was really helpful for us. Honestly, it helped from a standard in a financial way, like you would expect. It's nice to have a little money in the bank that you can rely on. But it also helped us psychologically get over the hump of hiring our first few employees. Our cash flow was on such a roller coaster at that point where one day we thought, wow, look at all these customers, it's fantastic. The next day, no customers would come in. And that would happen on a weekly and even a monthly basis. But it was nice to have that, you know, little nest egg in the bank where we could reasonably go out and talk with potential hires and say, yes, we can pay you this month and pay you next month. So this is going to be a great job versus like, hey, we had a great month, but based on our short history, we don't know how next month is going to turn out. So it gave us some confidence.
Yeah, I want to go into that a little bit because I think too often, especially in the technology space, there is this underlying feeling that all owners have that they have to have a VC, right? They have to have a venture capitalist. That's the only way, and that they may scrape together a few shekels from their friends and family, but to be really considered a contender, you've got to have the VC backing. Talk to us a little bit about that because you went through it, but then obviously you didn't get it and you're maybe probably better off for it. So talk a little bit about overcoming that psychology.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, early on, and this is a good little mini lesson. It was for me is that we had essentially a verbal agreement with a strategic investor. So it wasn't a venture capitalist, but it was a significant software company that had said, yeah, we'd like to come in, you know, for a pretty large check. And then later we'd like to, you know, continue to invest. And we thought that's great. And we wrote our first business plan, right? Because we'd launched without one, we just launched. And then that deal fell through because that company was acquired by an even larger software company. So that went away. And thankfully, number one lesson, we hadn't relied on it. So we hadn't done any spending ahead of getting the money, which I've seen subsequently in a couple other businesses where it's like, oh, well, the investors have said they're going to invest, so we're going to start ramping right now. That's tempting, but I'm glad that we didn't think to do that because that deal fell through and we didn't get the investment that came through from angels until several months later. And so we could have really harmed ourselves by pre-spending and then not having a source of that money. But at the end of the day, I think there are obvious great advantages to raising money from venture capitalists, namely just the cash. But secondarily, they can open up some markets, they have relationships, they can help drive toward an exit if that's the goal. On the flip side, I think some of the advantages of, you know, quote unquote bootstrapping or staying lightly funded are that you stay very focused on the core business because you simply can't afford the distraction. So I think sometimes, you know, any of us, if we, you know, if we've got $20 in our pocket, you know, to go out on a Friday night, we have certain limited options of things that we can do. You put $200 in your pocket and all of a sudden it's like, oh, maybe I should go see the big concert or go to the super nice restaurant. So not having the money simply just limits your options and you get, you know, pretty decent, I think in our case, at focusing on what we can do, which are the things that we can afford. So to give an example of that, we've always scaled our team, which is our most important thing and our biggest expense is payroll. We've always scaled our team along with or even slightly trailing growth. In other words, we've got to add more customers in order to expand the team. Frequently, if you take outside capital, it's, hey, you've got a great idea, let's build up a big team right now. And sometimes that works out really well and you can conquer a market or an industry. Other times though, and we've seen this happen a few times, including in our own space with competitors, you'll raise a lot of money, spend a ton of it, because that's the idea, you don't want it to burn a hole, you got to spend it, and then you build a big team and then it turns out, oh, it's not quite the right product or something changed in the market. And then you've got a lot of unwinding to do in order to do a restart. And that doesn't mean that's not possible to do, but there is a little bit of pain associated with it. So sometimes it's nice to be a little bit, you know, lighter on your feet and be able to limit your options intentionally.
So when you still are at that small, nimble period, how do you appear from the outside to have it together when you're really just two guys working in a cornfield? Mentioned that you launched without having a business plan, but you were able to successfully launch your business regardless of that. So what was important for your success at the beginning to look like you had it together?
I mean, one of my favorite quotes about entrepreneurs is that it's someone that wants to work 80 hours so they don't have to work 40. And it sounds silly, but for a lot of us, we sort of feel like, well, we've got all this energy and we want to apply it and we want to do it in lots of different ways. And entrepreneurship's great for that because it's not, your job isn't just to do support or just to do sales or just to do marketing. You get to / have to do all of it. And so I think it's safe to say, especially when it's just me and Ryan for the first 9 months of the life of the company, we just worked all the time. And that was fun. It's what we wanted to do. It wasn't a, oh my gosh, I have to work all the time. It's like, well, this is our company. We own it. We want to start it. We want it to be successful. We want to give it a fair chance. We thought that it was a good idea that Ryan had. We thought that there was a market there for it. And we thought that if we put, you know, enough elbow grease into it, that we could get it out to people, and we started receiving a lot of good feedback from customers. And of course, it's that external really good feedback that continues to fuel your enthusiasm for the company. I think all of us have enough energy internally to get things off the ground, but if it's just universally panned, if people just don't like it or it doesn't hit the market right, I think you can sustain for quite a while and keep pushing the rock up the hill. But at some point, for most of us, we go like, okay, maybe it's not the right direction. Maybe I should go do something else. So thankfully, we started to get some great initial customer feedback, and that helped us to push through the tough times when maybe the server goes down or there's a bug in the software or we didn't land the sale we thought was going to come through, stuff like that. So, it's an interesting process. I think, number one, you know, be ready and be excited to work a lot of hours. I don't know that there's a great substitute for that. So while I'm certainly in favor of, you know, all the conversations out there about, work-life balance and taking care of yourself, taking care of your health, all those things are very important. At the same time, I don't think any of us should shy away from like, hey, if we need to work all day, or we need to stay up at night to demo our software to a bunch of customers in Australia, or handle support tickets all day and not do sales, even though what we really love to do is close deals, but we need to support our existing customers, then be willing to do that. That's what the company needs. Later then, as we were able to start, you know, hiring some folks on the team, and even some before that, it's really about identifying force multipliers to the extent that you can find them. And I think you have to try a lot of things before you find the ones that actually work. So certainly having people brought onto your team, being able to hire people, is kind of the original force multiplier. You know, I don't have to do everything. I now have a few people that can help me and we can divide the work up. But then beyond that, we certainly, and everybody in our space of software, sales productivity software, we're always looking for tools and hacks that can, you know, help us appear to be and act like we're substantially bigger. So at the time we started 6 years ago, marketing automation was really scaling. You know, the ability to, hey, we got a mailing list at an event of 5,000 people. I can't possibly write individual emails to each of them. There's not enough time in the day, but I can load them up and create a personalized template and merge fields in. And we now do that for sales teams through our own software in Gmail also. It's a force multiplier. Like, there's so many leads to reach out to. There's so little time, but based on a clever mail merge and the ability to send them out in mass, we can reach out to a lot of people. So those would be, and there's lots of things like that. The ability to handle support tickets through a ticket system, putting up a good website, with a good video and some other things that present you in a professional way to the outside world, I think can help all of us that are running small companies appear to be larger, more stable, big and solid. Because by the time we started to hear from enterprise customers about a year, year and a half into our existence, then they would ask questions like, hey, we want to see your entire financial history and how many people are on the team and what's your org chart and what's your security model and so on. And so thankfully, by the time we got to that point, we had enough force multipliers in place that we could say, yeah, our team is small, but look at all the systems that we've set up in order to serve you, dear large client, and give them confidence that we can in fact do it.
Let me ask you from a psychology standpoint about this constant growth that you have subjected yourself to. I mean, at a very real sense, you had to grow a certain amount to pay back those initial investors, right? You had to get those friends and family, if you will, paid with something in there. But, yeah. You know, there is a point, I think, in every business where they get to a certain size and it becomes an inflection point. You know, you're starting to make some real money. You're probably making that call of, well, should I take this real money and apply it towards hiring more people or going into processes to improve them? Or should I probably take a little bit bigger distribution? You know, I've been getting a lousy paycheck for 2 years, whatever. Maybe it's time for me to kind of enjoy what I have as opposed to constantly reinvesting back in. Where is that inflection point for you? Have you gone through it? Is it something that you're like, you know what, I'm just going to burn, you know, the world up. And if I only make $10,000 a year, I don't care because I'm burning the world up. Talk a little bit about that psychology.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. It's very dependent on your particular personal circumstances, but also the type of business that you've started and that you're running. For us, Ryan and I have both been very strongly biased in favor of growth. So we could have, you know, slowed things down a bit in the past. We could have taken, you know, different levels of distributions out of the business. Instead, we've been very biased toward growth, namely because, you know, we've looked at the market and said, number one thesis, we don't think email is going away as a form of communication between salespeople and companies and their customers. So while internally, many of us as teams are using tools like Slack, while social networks are a big way to communicate, and especially for customer support or sort of initial sales increase, most of the real business that we see getting done out in the world still happens by email. You know, can you send me the contract to sign? Most of that happens by email, even if it's a digital signature. That original contract gets sent by email. Most of the back and forth conversations asking about product features or how does this service work all happens by email. So when we looked around and said, well, everybody has an email address, and more companies that are creating sales teams are coming on board with Gmail and with Office 365 and going to the cloud, which is where we like to live primarily, that we felt like was a very good omen for our future. And the fact that we really started and are still widely known as the app that connects Salesforce with your inbox, whether you're in Gmail or Outlook. And, you know, we're looking at Salesforce's growth and saying, this is a good sign. Salesforce is growing very fast. Salesforce growing fast and Google's growing fast. And we're the app that connects the two platforms. So let's keep reinvesting in growth with the hope that if we keep growing, then what we've built up equity in is has greater value later, right? So it's a risk profile analysis where if we felt like, well, if the risk was so great, you know, 2 weeks from now, then we ought to do everything we can do to take everything out now or as much as we can. But if we feel like 4 weeks from now it's going to be twice as valuable, well, we ought to plow everything back in. But I still remember early on in life of the company and after the first, 5-6 months probably, when it was like, hey, so we made a few sales. We're paying our hosting bill. It's just the two of us. Like, it'd be nice to pay ourselves a little bit, right? Keep the lights on. And by that time, I had left my full-time job and Ryan was winding down his consulting practice. So it was like, yeah, we both have young families, so we need to have some income. But taking that first check, sort of quote, out of the company, I still remember that because it made me nervous. I was like, gosh, shouldn't we leave more in, or, you know? But yeah, we wanted to write ourselves a small check just to say to ourselves, as well as, you know, to our loved ones, our spouses especially, like, hey, this has legs. What we're doing is starting to work, or it has signs of life. And so we're actually able to take, you know, a couple $1,000s out and pay some bills. And then from there, once we had some additional money coming in from customers and we're able to hire staff, then we made it very reliable, right? Because at that point, staff is getting paid every 2 weeks. And so we're going to get paid every 2 weeks. And I'm glad we did that. And Ryan was really the driver of that. Like, hey, we need to make sure that we're paid a reasonable amount on a very reliable schedule, like our quote, real job, right? Mm-hmm. Even though we're crazy entrepreneurs, let's make that standard. And a lot of the books will say that too, right? Sort of the quote unquote, pay yourself first, right? Make sure you get paid and then take care of everything else. Because if you do the reverse, sometimes people, you know, kind of forget to, or neglect rather, to pay themselves. And that can get kind of dangerous because then you're sacrificing a lot on the personal side into the business.
True. Well, I always like to say entrepreneur is the title you give yourself before you have success in a company, because every entrepreneur I know has a successful company is a CEO, a COO, some C-level suite, and rarely do they title themselves an entrepreneur, even though they are entrepreneurial to begin with.
Right, that's true.
Brandon, I really appreciate you being on the show, and thank you so much for sharing your insight with our audience.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Brandon. Great to be with
you. Thank you, guys.
And we will be right back after this short break. Hey, everyone. This is Sean Jackson, the host of The Digital Entrepreneur, and I want to ask you a simple question. What is your business framework for selling digital goods online? Now, if the question perplexes you, don't worry, you are not alone. Most people don't realize that the most successful digital entrepreneurs have a framework or a general process for creating and selling their digital goods in the online space. And one of the best free resources is Digital Commerce Academy. Digital Commerce Academy combines online learning with case studies and webinars created by people who make a living selling digital goods online. And the best part is that this material is free when you register. Are you interested in joining? Well, I'll make it easy for you. If you're listening to the show on your phone and are in the continental United States, I want you to send a text message to 313131 with the keyword digits, D-I-G-I-T-S. And when you send that text message, we will send you a link to the registration form right to your phone. Are you outside the United States? Don't worry. Just send us an email to digits@rainmaker.fm. Either way, we'll send you a link to the registration form so that you can sign up for free for Digital Commerce Academy. And as a special bonus, we will also subscribe you to our newsletter when you text or email us so that you can stay informed with the latest insights from the show. And don't worry, we respect your privacy and we will not share your email or phone number, and you can easily unsubscribe at any time. So if you want to start building or improving your framework for selling digital goods online, then please send a text to 313131 with the keyword digits, or send us an email at digits@rainmaker.fm. You won't be disappointed. Welcome back from the break, everyone. And Katie, for this portion of the show, we always like to give out a recommendation. And I've got one for you. You ready?
I'm ready.
Based on our topic today with Brandon, it made me think about this one chapter in a book that I absolutely love. The name of the book is called Originals by Adam Grant. He's the new Malcolm Gladwell, okay? Even out Malcolm Gladwell says he's the new Malcolm Gladwell. And Originals has in there several very powerful chapters, but this one chapter in particular really comes to mind about the founding of Warby Parker. You're familiar with those people?
I am.
So they basically came up with the eyeglass model. They realized that eyeglasses were too expensive, and they found out, hey, wait a minute, there's giant markup in them. We can do it better online. Well, they started out at the University of Chicago, and their professor was Adam Grant, the guy writing this book. And they asked him to invest in Warby Parker, which went on to go public and make all sorts of crazy money for its founders. And he declined. And the reason he declined was fascinating, because when he talked with these kids, essentially, they were very risk averse. They were, you know, almost everything that they were looking at was really, well, should I keep my job and still do this on the side? I mean, they were not the devil make hair, throw it all against the wall, see what sticks type of people, which is
the opposite of what most people think millennials and Gen Z are, right?
Exactly. So because they didn't fit his preconceived mold, he didn't invest in them. But then, because of their success, he actually looked into some research about entrepreneurs. And you know what he found, Katie?
I think I can guess.
What do you think?
Is it that this repeatable risk-averse thing actually has something to it?
Exactly. What he found was most entrepreneurial-founded companies are highly risk-averse, that they are not just doing anything because they can. They actually take very measured steps to define what is the reward, what is the risk. So I think for anyone listening to the show that thinks that being an entrepreneur or trying to grow a company is all about crazy risk and throwing it all out there, the truth is this. It's a value proposition of incremental steps towards success. It is taking a calculated small risk to find the big return. Just like our guest today mentioned that they were looking at small little things that had big impact. So is the case when an entrepreneurial-led company is looking to grow. It's a series of small bets, not the one big one that you think will change it all. Pretty interesting, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I loved particularly how Brandon said, you know, there really is no replacement for just good old-fashioned hard work. That there isn't an easy, quick win. That you need to put in the work, build the quality product, and put the customer first. And that is the true recipe for success.
And that is a perfect way to end this show. Have a great week, everyone. We'll catch you next time.